Dawn of Flame by Stanley G. Weinbaum. Chapter 4. The Battle of Eagle Foot Flow. The men of the Confederation were pouring into Ormiston all night long. The little dark men of Chicago and St. Louis, the tall blonde ones from the regions of Iowa, where Dutch blood still survived, mingled now with a Scandinavian infusion from the upper rivers. All night there was a rumble of wagons bringing powder and ball from St. Louis, and food as well, for Ormiston couldn't even attempt to feed so many ravenous mouths. A magnificent army, 10,000 strong, and all of them seasoned fighting men, trained in a dozen little wars and in the bloody war of the lakes and rivers, when Chicago had bitten so large a piece from St. Louis territories. The stand was to be at Ormiston, and Norse, the only settlement now between Joaquin Smith and the Confederation, was left to its fate. Experienced leaders had examined the territory and had agreed on a plan. 3 miles south of the town, the road followed an ancient railroad cut, with 50-foot embankments on either side, heavily wooded for a mile north and south of the bridge across Eagle Foot Flow. Along this course, they were to distribute their men, a single line where the bluffs were hit high and steep, massed forces where the terrain permitted. Joaquin Smith must follow the road. There was no other. An ideal situation for ambush, and a magnificently simple plan. So magnificent and so simple that it could not fail, they said, and forgot completely that they were facing the supreme military genius of the entire age of the Enlightenment. It was mid-morning when the woods runners that had been sent into Ozarkie returned with breathtaking news. Joaquin Smith had received the St. Louis defiance of his representations and was marching. The master was marching, and though they had come swiftly and had ridden horseback from Norse, he could not now be far distant. His forces? The runners estimated them at 4,000 men, all mounted, with perhaps another 1,000 auxiliaries. Outnumbered 2-1. But Hall Tarvish remembered tales of other encounters where Joaquin Smith had overcome greater odds than these. The time was at hand. In the little room beside File Ormiston's workshop, Hall was going over his weapons while Vale Ormiston, pale and nervous and very lovely, watched him. He drew a bit of oiled rag through the bore of the rifle she had given him, rubbed a spot of rust from the hammer, blew a speck of dust from the pan. Beside him on the table lay powder horn and ball, and his steel bow leaned against his chair. "A sweet weapon," he said admiringly, sighting down the long barrel.
I hope it serves you well," murmured Vale tremulously. "Hall, he must be stopped. He must."
"We'll try, Vale." He rose. "It's time I started."
She was facing him. "Then, before you go, will you kiss me, Hall?"
He strode toward her, then recoiled in sudden alarm, for it was at that instant that the thing happened. There was a series of the faintest possible clicks, and Hall fancied that he saw for an instant a glistening of tiny blue sparks on candlesticks and metal objects around the room, and that he felt for a brief moment a curious tingling. Then he forgot all these strange trifles as the powder horn on the table roared into terrific flame, and flaming wads of powder shot meteor-like around him. For an instant he froze rigid. Vale was screaming. Her dress was burning. He moved into sudden action, sweeping her from her feet, crashing her sideways to the floor, where his great hands beat out the fire. Then he slapped table and floor. He brought his ample sandals down on flaming spots. And finally, there were no more flames. He turned, coughing and choking in the black smoke, and bent over Vale, who gasped, half overcome. Her skirt had burned to her knees, and for the moment she was too distraught to cover them, though there was no modesty in the world in those days like that of the women of the Middle River regions. But as Hall leaned above her, she huddled back.
"Are you hurt?" he cried. "Vale, are you burned?"
"No, no," she panted.
"Then outside," he snapped, reaching down to lift her.
"Not like this."
He understood.
He snatched his leather smith's apron from the wall, whipped it around her, and bore her into the clearer air of the street. Outside there was chaos. He set Vale gently on the step and surveyed a scene of turmoil. Men ran shouting, and from windows along the street black smoke poured. A dozen yards away, a powder wagon had blasted itself into a vast mushroom of smoke, incinerating horses and driver alike. On the porch across the way lay a writhing man, torn by the rifle that had burst in his hands. He comprehended suddenly.
"The Sparkers!" he roared. "Joaquin Smith's Sparkers! Old Einar told me about them." He groaned. "There goes our ammunition."
The girl made a great effort to control herself.
"Joaquin Smith's sorcery," she said dully. "There goes hope as well."
He started.
"Hope? No, wait, Vale."
He rushed towards the milling group that surrounded bearded old Marcus Ormiston and the Confederation leaders. He plowed his way fiercely through and seized the panic-stricken Greybeard.
"What now?" he roared. "What are you going to do?"
"Do? Do?"
The old man was past comprehending.
"Yes, do. I'll tell you."
He glared at the five leaders.
"You'll carry through. Do you see? For powder and ball, there's bow and sword, and just as good for the range we need. Gather your men. Gather your men and march."
And such, within the hour, was the decision. Hall marched first with the Ormiston men, and he carried with him the memory of Vale's farewell. It embarrassed him cruelly to be kissed thus in public, but there was great pleasure in the glimpse of Enoch Ormiston's sour face as he had watched her. The Ormiston men were first on the line of the master's approach, and they filtered to their forest-hidden places as silently as foxes. Hall let his eyes wander back along the cut, and what he saw pleased him, for no eye could have detected that along the deserted road lay 10,000 fighting men. They were good woodsmen, too, these fellows from the upper rivers and the saltless seas. Down the way from Norse, a single horseman came galloping. Old Marcus Ormiston recognized him, stood erect, and hailed him. They talked. Hall could hear the words. The master had passed through Norse, pausing only long enough to notify the Eldark that henceforth his taxes must be transmitted to New Orleans, and then had moved leisurely onward. No, there had been no sign of sorcery, nor had he even seen any trace of the witch Black Margot. But then he had ridden away before the master had well arrived. Their informant rode on towards Ormiston, and the men fell to their quiet waiting. A half hour passed, and then, faintly drifting on the silent air, came the sound of music, singing, men's voices in song. Hall listened intently, and his skin crept, and his hair prickled as he made out the words of the battle song of New Orleans.
"Queen of cities reigning, Empress starry pearled, see our arms sustaining, battle flags unfurled. Hear our song rise higher, fierce as battle fire, death our one desire, o'er the empire of the world."
Hall gripped his bow and set feather to cord. He knew well enough that the plan was to permit the enemy to pass unmolested until his whole line was within the span of the ambush. But the rumble of that distant song was like spark to powder. And now, far down the way, beyond the cut, he saw the dust rising. Joaquin Smith was at hand. Then, the unexpected. Ever afterward, Hall told himself that it should have been the expected, that the master's reputation should have warned them that so simple a plan as theirs must fail. There was no time now for such vain thoughts, for suddenly, through the trees to his right, brown-clothed, lithe little men were slipping like charging shadows, horns sounding, whistles shrilling. The woods runners of the master! Joaquin Smith had anticipated just such an ambush. Instantly, Hall saw their own weakness. They were 10,000, true enough, but here they were strung thinly over a distance of 2 miles, and now the woods runners were at a vast advantage in numbers, with the main body approaching. One chance! Fight it out, drive off the scouts, and retire into the woods.
While the army existed, even though Ormiston fell, there was hope. He shouted, strung his arrow, and sent it flashing through the leaves. A bad place for arrows. Their arching flight was always deflected by the tangled branches. He slung bow on shoulder and gripped his sword. Close quarters was the solution, the sort of fight that made blood tingle and life seem joyous. Then, the second surprise. The woods runners had flashed their own weapons, little blunt revolvers. But they sent no bullets. Only pale beams darted through leaves and branches, faint blue streaks of light. Sorcery? And to what avail? He learned instantly. His sword grew suddenly scorching hot in his hands, and a moment later the queerest pain he had ever encountered racked his body. A violent, stinging, inward tingle that twitched his muscles and paralyzed his movements. A brief second, and the shock ceased, but his sword lay smoking in the leaves, and his steel bow had seared his shoulders. Around him, men were yelling in pain, writhing on the ground, running back into the forest depths. He cursed the beams. They flicked like sunlight through branched and leafy tangles where an honest arrow could find no passage. Yet apparently no man had been killed. Hands were seared and blistered by weapons that grew hot under the blue beams. Bodies were racked by the torture that Hall could not know was electric shock. But none was slain. Hope flared again, and he ran to head off a retreating group. "To the road!" he roared. "Out where our arrows can fly free! Charge the column!" For a moment, the group halted. Hall seized a yet unheeded sword from someone and turned back. "Come on!" he bellowed. "Come on! We'll have a fight of this yet!" Behind him, he heard the trample of feet. The beams flicked out again, but he held his sword in the shadow of his own body, gritted his teeth, and bore the pain that twisted him. He rushed on. He heard his own name bellowed in the booming voice of File Ormson, but he only shouted encouragement and burst out into the full sunlight of the road. Below in the cut was the head of the column, advancing placidly. He glimpsed a silver-helmeted, black-haired man on a great white mare at its head, and beside him a slighter figure on a black stallion. Joaquin Smith! Hall roared down the embankment toward him. Four men spurred instantly between him and the figure with the silver helmet. A beam flicked. His sword scorched his skin, and he flung it away. "Come on!" he bellowed. "Here's a fight!" Strangely, in curious clarity, he saw the eyes of the Empire men, a smile in them, mysteriously amused. No anger, no fear, just amusement. Hall felt a sudden surge of trepidation, glanced quickly behind him, and knew finally the cause of that amusement. No one had followed him. He had charged the master's army alone. Now, the fiercest anger he had ever known gripped Hall. Deserted! Abandoned by those for whom he fought! He roared his rage to the echoing cliffs and sprang at the horseman nearest him. The horse reared, pawing the air. Hall thrust his mighty arms below its belly and heaved with a convulsion of his great muscles. Backward toppled steed and rider, and all about the master was a milling turmoil where a man scrambled desperately to escape the clashing hooves. But Hall glimpsed Joaquin Smith sitting statue-like and smiling on his great white mare. He tore another rider from his saddle, and then caught from the corner of his eye, he saw the slim youth at the master's side raise a weapon, coolly, methodically. For the barest instant, Hall faced icy green eyes where cold, passionless death threatened. He flung himself aside as a beam spat smoking against the dust of the road. "Don't!" snapped Joaquin Smith, his low voice clear through the turmoil. "The youth is splendid." But Hall had no mind to die uselessly. He bent, flung himself halfway up the bluff in a mighty leap, caught a dragging branch, and swung into the forest. A startled woods runner faced him. He flung the fellow down behind him, down the slope, and slipped into the shelter of leaves. "A wise warrior fights pride," he muttered to himself. "It's no disgrace for one man to run from an army." He was mountain bred. He circled silently through the forest, avoiding the woods runners who were herding the Confederation army back towards Ormiston. He smiled grimly as he recalled the words he had spoken to Vale. He had justified them. He had charged the army of the Master alone. Footnote 2. The Erden resonators, a device now obsolete that projected an inductive field sufficient to induce tiny electrical discharges in metal objects up to a distance of many miles. Thus it ignited inflammables like gunpowder. Footnote 3. Kolbermar's ionic beams. Two parallel beams of highly actinic light ionize a path of air, and along these conductive lanes of gas, an electric current can be passed, powerful enough to kill, or merely intense enough to punish. End of chapter 4.